The rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you.
One video that rings true to people posted on YouTube is difficult to silence, even for the proverbial powers that be.
The bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 717 of Unwelcome Guests, one video posted on YouTube. I'm Robin Upton. Now, that comment of mine from our last episode seemed apposite to begin this one, because, what do you know, last week I come across a video on YouTube
and I immediately thought, yeah, this rings true to me, I need to share this with a wider audience. And you're the wider audience?
Now, I'm afraid I have utterly failed to turn up a lot of corroborating evidence about the existence of the guy concerned, whose name is Bo Abbott. And we're a bit short of time. Normally speaking, I would have cut out the hesitations and misspeakings, because I find that amplifies the speaker's message. But I thought I'll leave them in, more or less, because that will help you judge the credibility or otherwise of what he's saying. He's speaking straight to a camera. We don't see the interviewer, although he asks a couple of questions at the end, and I believe his name is John Gentry of Dallas, Texas, and the interview was reportedly at the request of political prisoner Steve Webb, who shared a cell with Bo Abbott for a few months and spoke to him daily. There isn't a lot to see in the video, it's basically just a talking head. I shall link to it anyway from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguest.net/717, and I believe it was recorded in the 1990s.
In 1968, I was working for Olivetti Underwood Corporation in Houston. By 1969, I had become the number one salesman in the United States. My father-in-law was involved in export-import and advised me that the British pound sterling was going to be changed to a decimal 10 system, and this would require a great need for used American business machines in England. So I flew to London in 1969 and set up a business to sell used machines in England. Eventually, this led into Scandinavia, and I ended up in Stockholm, Sweden, working for Olivetti, or we should say Svenska Olivetti, in Stockholm, Sweden. Police chief of Stockholm secured me a work permit because I had certain knowledge of equipment in the United States that had not been introduced into Sweden, and they needed someone in Stockholm to instruct and sell this equipment. Therefore, I ended up with this work permit from the police chief. And over a period of time, I became quite successful in selling used business machines in Stockholm. Eventually, the CIA, or someone claiming to be with the CIA, contacted me and explained that not much of the equipment was ending up in the hands of the Soviet Union and their satellite countries such as Poland, East Germany, and Czechoslovakia. They asked me to continue to sell my equipment and even helped me acquire certain equipment that they thought would be of some technical value to the Soviet bloc. Basically, what this was a reverse sting to identify the people that were buying the equipment, and we were trying to put a trace on the equipment, see where it actually ended up. This went on for about 6 months, and eventually the CIA explained to me that I should leave because many people that were my customers were reporting that I was working for the U.S. government in more or less a reverse sting operation for technology transfer. I closed the office down and moved back to the United States and continued working for Olivetti Underwood Corporation. Then, this was about 1971. In 1972, I had a business going where I was importing motorcycles and motorcycle parts from all over the world, mostly Japan and England and Germany. The shop was broken into and a large part of my inventory was stolen. The Houston police couldn't do anything about it, and they advised me to contact the DEA because they believed that a group of drug dealers had actually stolen the merchandise. So in my conversation with DEA, I agreed to go to work for them in order to catch the people that had stolen the merchandise from my motorcycle shop. Over a period of time, I ended up making introductions to Ron Gospodarek of the Houston office. Ron is now a high official with DEA in Washington, D.C. Many large cases were made in the Houston area. One of the biggest cases was the case against the Greek heroin smuggling operation of Aristotle Onassis. I quickly learned that the DEA was only interested in pursuing this case so far. When it came to infiltrating the top echelons, they quickly dropped the case. Me being a young man, believing in my country, believing that I was doing the right thing, believing that I was helping the people of America stay away from illegal drugs, this really confused and confounded me. And eventually Ron Gospodarek and Gordon White explained to me that the CIA was involved and that there were national security interests and that the case was not going to go any further. After this case was finished, the DEA sent me into Mexico, they sent me into West Texas, they sent me all over the United States. And in particular, I was involved in going into Mexico and breaking up large-scale heroin smuggling operations. There were too many of them to name. None of them were of any great significance, but the significant point is that I was working for the DEA, I was being paid, and I was an undercover agent. At one point, they advised me to become a pilot so that I could infiltrate certain drug gangs better. They paid for my training, they paid for my pilot's license, and then eventually, by about 1978, they sent me to the FAA Academy in Oklahoma City. Bill Collar, a high-level agent for the DEA, trained me in DEA aircraft how to make soft feel and short feel landings and trained me for ocean survival and jungle survival in case I was forced down or had to crash. My assignments were skipping around from Copenhagen, Denmark, Stockholm, Sweden, all over the United States, Bolivia, Panama, Nicaragua, Belize, Colombia, Peru, Paraguay, and I don't have enough time in this interview to go into great detail of what I did in each country. But again, the significant point is the DEA was using me in an undercover capacity. Specifically, in 1979 in Bolivia, I began to understand the agenda of the CIA. They were there in Bolivia to make sure that the DEA only caught the small people. Sonia Atala, Walter Atala, Roberto Suarez organization, which was the largest cocaine smuggling organization in the world at that time, supplied the Cali and the Medellin cartel and the CIA with their cocaine. My job was to notify all of the large-scale Bolivian smugglers that were working for CIA on impending arrest and drug bust in Bolivia so as that the higher echelons would not be arrested. In particular, the Roberto Suarez organization was a protected organization. I was advised about Mike Levine operating out of Buenos Aires as the station chief for DEA, the movements of his informers and his agents coming into Bolivia were monitored, and I passed that information on to the Bolivian drug smuggling organizations in order that they wouldn't get caught. The CIA eventually started shipping large-scale, well, in fact, tons of cocaine into Panama, into Tucumán Airport. They were flying LAB marked 727s and 707s, and they would pull into a warehouse district on the backside of Tucumán Airport, where they'd be protected by the Panamanian Defense Forces when they used forklifts to unload pallets of cocaine and placed into Sonia Atala's warehouse. Sonia Atala also had another company on the Atlantic side of Panama in the Colon Free Trade Zone. These companies more or less served to, they were really a front to ship radios and TVs, mostly Hitachi, that was the brand that they were using, back to Bolivia and to Paraguay. However, the real purpose of the company was to bring cocaine into Panama for distribution by the Mossad and by the CIA. This cocaine was flown into Nicaragua, into Belize. The planes were refueled there, and then it was flown into the United States. Now, it was probably flown into other locations, but the only two locations that I know about for refueling cocaine flights were in Nicaragua and in Belize. Now then, arms were also put in these warehouses. The Israeli Mossad seized a lot of arms in Lebanon. These arms were shipped into Panama, put into this warehouse and other warehouses. And then they were flown into the Contras in Nicaragua by pilots. Several of the pilots that I knew were Floyd Carlton, Cesar Rodriguez, Enrique Pretelt, Daniel Miranda, and there were several other pilots in Panama that may or may not have known they were ultimately doing the CIA's bidding for them by flying drugs and arms. It was my understanding that Noriega had worked out an agreement with the CIA to allow his country to be used for drug and arms smuggling. They would put him in power and maintain him. And it was kind of a working arrangement where he would give up certain small-level dealers that the DEA wanted and protect the large-scale ones that were CIA assets. I can tell you this, that Isla Contadora, where the Shah of Iran lived for a short period of time before his death, was owned by Gabriel Lewis. Gabriel Lewis had a brother who owned Banco del Istmo in Panama. Cesar Rodriguez accepted many airplanes in Isla Contadora with money or the proceeds of CIA cocaine drug smuggling operations in the United States. This money was taken to Banco del Istmo and BCCI Bank. I think it's significant that Gabriel Lewis last year, I don't know about this year, was the U.S. ambassador from Panama. I think it's also significant that just prior to the Noriega kidnapping, I don't know what else you can call it other than a kidnapping, invasion of his country, Gabriel Lewis was rescued by a twin-engine airplane sent out of Costa Rica by Bill Clinton's friend.
Which one?
The banker. I can't think of his name. I'll come back to it later. I can't think of the banker's name, but it's also significant that I had flown money out of Arkansas and eastern Arkansas, just west of Memphis, and near a little town called Mariana. I had also, it's near Forest City. I had flown arms and money out of this area into Belize and Nicaragua and Panama. And at one instance, I picked up a load of cocaine out of this warehouse in Panama and flew it on a plane that was provided to me by the DEA out of Panama. And I flew it into this airstrip. A DEA agent out of Memphis met me. The airport was protected by an Arkansas State Police officer. And I must admit, I don't know what happened to the cocaine. I was not involved in selling it in the United States. My job was to get it delivered from Panama and to stop and have it refueled in Belize. The northwestern part of the country of Belize was not a very good location for Coca-Cola Minute Maid to buy almost 20% of the country of Belize, ostensibly to raise citrus fruit because of the U.S. freezes. But anyway, this land was bought. It had no outlet to the sea. This land was used for airstrips for refueling arms and drug flights, and it was also used to train Contras. And when this load of cocaine I flew out of Panama came into Belize, people that I believe were CIA assets refueled me. Also, when I flew arms out of Louisiana and Texas and Arkansas, I would land in Belize in the northwestern part and either continue on after being refueled or give the plane over to another pilot.
What types of planes?
I was flying mostly Piper Senecas, Piper Aztecs, Cessna 310s, Cessna 210s, Cessna 206, Piper Navajos. This is, I think, significant that the FAA had and the DEA had spent money on me learning how to successfully do short field and soft field landings. Let me take a break. Can I just take this off? All creatures, comforts of home. Okay. Jackson Stevens, one of Bill Clinton's friends, was instrumental in securing a twin-engine aircraft to rescue Gabriel Lewis just prior to the invasion of Panama. This plane, I believe, belonged to United Fruit Company. Now, I never met Jackson Stevens, but the interesting thing was that the cocaine that I flew into Arkansas and the money that and the arms that I flew out went into Gabriel Lewis's brother's bank, Banco del Istmo, and it went through BCCI. The U.S. attorney from the District of New York expressed some interest in me explaining how this money laundering was done, but nothing ever came of it. Cesar Rodriguez, the pilot and the friend of Noriega, had cleared a lot of airplanes full of money through Isla Contadora. Also, Cesar Rodriguez and I were such good friends that we realized that at some point we could become expendable. So we began gathering information, and I was giving it to my Swedish girlfriend from Stockholm, and she was putting it in a safety deposit box in Berlin, Germany. This information included a lot of the locations where they were flying arms and drugs and money throughout Central America, throughout Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, the names of banks. It even had tape recordings of Noriega talking to CIA officials about drug smuggling and arms smuggling. We believe that at some point, if they ever tried to make a move against us, that we could, in fact, take that information and use it against them to secure our freedom. Over a period of time, I began to wonder what the real agenda of the United States government was. At first, I believed that there was a war on drugs, that they were trying to stop drugs and protect the people. Then the next excuse was, well, we need to defeat the communists. They're in Central America. You need to go in and pose as a drug smuggler and find out about arms shipments, Cuban advisors, Russian advisors. And, of course, my cover was that I was a drug smuggler. No one else, other than a drug smuggler, could safely travel around Central America without being suspected of working for the CIA or the U.S. government. This information that I had gathered also, well, let me say it in a different way. Over a period of time, traveling all over the world and having the ability to speak five languages, I read newspapers from Northern Europe and also from Spain and from Latin America. And I realized that the U.S. was not the bastion of freedom that we had grown to believe it was. I learned that many of the devious things that the Soviet Union did, we also did. And it was common knowledge in 1979 in Europe that the U.S. military-industrial complex was unnecessary, that the Russians would fall apart, literally would implode, if they were left alone. That this Reagan and Carter election was a sham on the American people on Reagan's part, because the military-industrial complex didn't need to be built up. The Russian people didn't believe in the system. They didn't have enough to eat. They didn't believe Pravda. And again, it was common knowledge in Northern Europe that within 10 years, the Russian system would fail. Over a period of time, I began to question what I was doing, and I wanted out. My Swedish girlfriend convinced me to stop working for the DEA and the CIA, to take up Swedish citizenship, and to completely cease and desist from all U.S. activity and never come back into the U.S. again. I went to my CIA contacts in Panama and explained to them that I wanted out. They protested and told me that I couldn't get out, that I knew too much, that I was too valuable, that I'd made too many connections all over the Americas. And when I insisted, they finally gave in. What's interesting is approximately 3 weeks later, I learned from the Aspen police, who were my friends, that there were people on my land with high-powered rifles that didn't appear to be hunters, that they were watching my house. I figured there was a hit out on me, so I left. I flew to Houston in one of my private airplanes. I went to my ex-wife's house and told her that I was going to be leaving the country and moving to Sweden, and I said goodbye to my daughter. When I stepped out of the house, and walked down the street, I was surrounded by plainclothes people driving Pontiac Firebirds and Chevrolet Camaros, and I didn't know who they were, so I started running. They chased me. A helicopter came after me. I eventually ran in an abandoned building that was under construction, and while I could see the helicopter lights on one end of the building, I ran out the other building and ran through a bayou in a field and escaped these people. I heard them say, "Don't shoot him in the back." Okay. Later that night, some people came to my ex-wife's house and told her that they were DEA agents and that they had an arrest warrant for me. She allowed them to search the house and the garage, and they left. Then sometime later, my parents reported to me that Agent Richard Brazil out of San Antonio had come by the house and wanted to know where I was. My parents told him they didn't know. A week later, I contacted Ken Wincorn, an attorney in Dallas. He called the DEA three times within a week and offered to surrender me. They maintained that they did not want me. He called the DPS. They did not want me. So it was clear to me that whoever wanted me was going to kill me. So I continued to run. Eventually, through some of my contacts in Bolivia that worked also for the CIA, it was learned that I was in Cancun, Mexico. I was accosted, beaten, wrapped in chains by thugs that the U.S. government hired. I was brought back to the United States on an airplane in chains. I think that's called kidnapping, but the U.S. maintains that it's okay. We can go around the world, kidnap anybody, and do any illegal thing we want to. I told the Mexican authorities I wanted to go to Panama or Sweden. They said, "You don't have any choice. The DEA is going to take you back, and that's it." In a pre-trial hearing, Agent Richard Brazil admitted on the stand under oath that he had purposely kept all of the information out of the DEA computer because he knew that I had very high-level connections in the DEA, and that he was afraid that I would learn about the case against me. Eventually, I learned that other DEA officials had also been arrested, and that other CIA contacts that I had flown drugs and arms with and money had been murdered. While I was awaiting trial in San Antonio, the prison chaplain by the name of Crook — it's an interesting name for a prison chaplain, but he was a nice enough fellow — he came to me and told me that I had to go to the chapel. He had some bad news. I was informed that my Swedish wife, the mother of my child, had been found on a railroad track in Germany, that she had committed suicide. I didn't believe it for a minute, but that was what he told me. Then a week later, I was informed that Cesar Rodriguez, my friend and Noriega's friend, had been found in Colombia with his throat cut. This is a symbol called a Colombian necktie. It means you talked. Now remember, my Swedish wife had compiled the information about Noriega and the CIA in a safety deposit box in Berlin, Germany. I realized very quickly that if I went to trial, I'd probably either end up dead or I had no supporting evidence. So when I did finally go in front of Judge Fred Shannon in San Antonio, I was asked if I was guilty, and I told him, yes, I was guilty of smuggling cocaine from Panama and through Belize and through Nicaragua. And then He asked if I was pleading guilty for any other reason. Was there a deal made? Was there a promise? Were there any threats? And I said, well, I don't think there's any deals, and there's probably no promises other than I'm not supposed to get more than 15 years. But I do not want to go to trial and embarrass the U.S. government and the DEA and the CIA, because I'm afraid I'll end up dead, like my former colleague, Sante Barrio, who was murdered with a poisoned peanut butter sandwich in the Bexar County Jail. Nothing was done about it, and I'm afraid that the same fate would fall on me if I tried to embarrass the U.S. government by explaining what I was doing while working for the government. The judge was quite shocked and asked my attorney, one of my attorneys, Tex McConathy, to prove that I was working for the government. He presented my logbook, my official logbook, showing that I had been flying around the U.S. and the world in numerous DEA-registered aircraft, and that I'd been trained by DEA to make soft and short field landings in DEA aircraft. Judge Shannon accepted this as fact. Then he said, okay, you're guilty, and that's it. The end of the guilty plea hearing. Well, according to the law, this didn't satisfy something called a factual basis for the crime. It was my belief that Judge Shannon knew that something crooked was going on. He didn't want to be a part of it. This is my educated guess. Because approximately 30 days after sentencing me, he quit. The man was in his 40s and appeared to be in very good health to me, and went to work in a private law firm. Now, I've never talked to the judge. I don't know exactly what went on, but you can conclude for yourself from the facts what may have happened. I later tried to call the press in. I was written up in the newspaper, and the newspaperman said that there was obviously some sort of a cover-up, because there was a lot of whispering in front of the bench out of the earshot of the public. Now, the Sixth Amendment says you're supposed to have a speedy and a public trial. When I attempted to talk to the press, I was moved around from prison to prison. Finally, when the press found me and were making attempts to come in and see me, the warden at Bastrop Prison and the captain came to me and told me that there was a murder contract out on me and that I had to go to the hole. That's solitary confinement for my own protection. The warden explained to me that he had a career and he didn't know what I'd done or who I was involved with, but he wasn't going to lose one of his prisoners and have his career ruined. This happened in 1984 or 83, I'm not sure which. Incidentally, this warden in 1994 had been demoted to a common guard at Springfield Prison and was just awaiting his retirement. Now, again, I don't know why he was demoted. All I know is that he was demoted. Later, my attorney that had exposed my logbook, Tex McConathy, had a nervous breakdown and has never practiced law since then. I don't know why he had the nervous breakdown. All I know is the facts that he did have one, and he has not practiced law. Incidentally, I stayed in the hole for 90 days, and then I was let out of the hole and went back in front of a different judge, Hippolito Garcia, and I was offered a chance to have a new trial or plead guilty. Having no information, having my family threatened with murder, having my body put in a hole for 90 days, I decided that the best thing to do would be plead guilty a second time and not make any waves. When you're not allowed to make bond when all your documents, all your information is destroyed, when your life's on the line, you don't put up a very good fight in court. After release from prison in 1986, I stayed in prison approximately 3 years. I was coming up on my 5-year date of being out of prison without being arrested. Normally, you should get off of federal parole if you've been 5 years without being arrested or violating your parole. Because of my criminal record, I was unable to secure meaningful employment, so I was washing airplanes as a living. I phoned my parole officer, a Mrs. Barron out of Arlington, and told her secretary that I was going to Austin. Her secretary advised me to come in and get a permit. I was remiss, and I didn't go in and get the permit. I went to Austin anyway. While down there and while washing planes, I was approached by Robert Nestor for the Department of Public Safety Air Smuggling Detail. Since he had been protecting me on my arms and drugs flights from the early 80s, I knew him well. And in fact, I was planning on going into the Noriega trial and explaining to the jury about the cocaine, drug smuggling, arms smuggling operation out of Panama and Bolivia and Nicaragua into Texas, and how Nestorov was protecting these drug flights. So, to make a long story short, Nestorov and his friends showed up, arrested me and two other gentlemen. I'm sorry, Nestorov and his fellow DPS officers took me to jail along with two other men without arresting us. They searched the plane, they searched several cars, they searched several houses, and the next morning they returned to jail and said, "Let them go. We can't find any laws they've broken." So I started to walk out of jail, and they said, "No, hold this guy because we're going to get his parole violated for being in Austin without a permission from his parole officer." I told these DPS officers, including Nestorov, that that was not their job, that it was my understanding that if there was a violation, I'd deal with my parole officer. And since they didn't have an arrest warrant, that I'd just leave and go back to Dallas and talk to my parole officer. Well, they didn't like that idea, so they put me in jail, again, without arresting me. They held me until the next day, and then they did get an arrest warrant. It's kind of, I think it's called getting the cart before the horse. Then, 90 days later, they took me into the back room of Bastrop Prison near Austin without an attorney, without the public being present. And I was charged with being out of bounds, and I pled guilty to being out of bounds because I technically did not get the written permit, even though the parole officer knew where I was. The penalty for this was 60 days. When I left the room, I kind of felt that these parole commissioners were up to something. 5 minutes later, when I came back, they told me they had made up an additional charge of smuggling drugs in a conspiracy, utilizing my flying ability, and that this activity was similar to my previous activity, and instead of 60 days with good time, I should get 20 months with no good time. I protested that, and I have it on tape, that Nestorov was a liar, a drug smuggler, and that he was getting to me to keep me from testifying in the Noriega trial. They said that that didn't matter to them. Later, I appealed this conviction, and I asked for the specific drug that I was smuggling, the country I was smuggling it from, to, and through. I asked for the names of the co-conspirators. I asked for the specific airplane, and I wanted to know when I did it. The parole commission said that my conviction was affirmed because I failed to convince them in my appeal that I was not doing what I was accused of. Now, I'm not a rocket scientist, but this seemed like to me it was an Orwellian thought crime. I don't know what else it could be. At this point, I wrote a lot of information about the drug and arms flights that I had made and that I knew about, and about the political involvement of CIA and Noriega in drug smuggling, the Bolivian-Paraguayan connection. And I wrote it, and I gave it to a trustee who said he could smuggle it out of prison and mail it from a post office box on a golf course where he worked as a cleanup man. Apparently, this letter did arrive to Joe Miranda in Austin, Texas. I called Joe on the monitored prison phone and learned that he had received the letter. And in discussing it, I think Frank Rubino, Noriega's lawyer, came up. That was who he was supposed to turn this information over to, and also the press. Shortly thereafter, the police, I think it was the DEA, raided Joe Miranda's house with a search warrant. No drugs, no money was found. No evidence of drug smuggling was found, but these papers were taken. Later, Joe was charged in a dry conspiracy to sell drugs or smuggle drugs, I'm not sure which. He hired Dick DeGaron out of Houston, who defended David Koresh and some of the cult members. Dick DeGaron filed motions, pretrial discovery motions, to get these papers returned. They were never returned, and the case against Joe Miranda was dismissed. I was sent to the Springfield Prison in Missouri. This is the mental prison and the hospital for federal prisoners. While there, under protest, I was given a forensic evaluation. Forensic means medicine and law. In one of the dirty jails somewhere or another, I had contacted TB. I was taking prophylactic medicine to prevent the onset of TB. While en route from Springfield back to Montgomery, Alabama, for a competency hearing, I was taking my TB medicine in a small county jail. The elderly black nurse turned her back, and I stole my forensic evaluation out of my medical jacket. It clearly stated on it, no psychosis found. It was signed by the chief of the department at Springfield. I mailed this to author Rodney Stitch, who wrote about me and defrauding America. Then when I got to Alabama, I was again ordered to undergo a second psychiatric examination by Dr. Guy Renfro. I protested, but had no choice in the matter. And so he gave me about an hour and a half worth of examination. And then I was taken into court. My court-appointed attorney was obviously on the government side and was going to sell me out, so I told him to sit down and shut up and I would conduct my own hearing. I asked Judge Thompson if this would be permitted, and he agreed. In questioning Dr. Renfro, I proved that he had contacted Dr. Murad in Springfield and had discussed my case with him. I asked the doctor, Dr. Guy Renfro, several questions. Number one, I asked him, would it have been more scientific if he had started fresh and found his own results rather than contacting the previous doctor? He admitted it. He also admitted under oath that he had never taken the Hippocratic Oath. He also admitted that a large percentage of his firm's revenue came from court-appointed examinations. Um, I thought that I had done a good job. Everyone else in the court thought I had done a good job. And I don't think there was anyone in attendance who really believed that I was insane. However, Judge Thompson agreed with both of the psychiatrists that I was insane and sent me back to Springfield for a 120-day restoration to competency. During this time, I made it known to Judge Thompson that someone was committing fraud in his court, that I had a copy, or that, I'm sorry, that I had the original forensic evaluation showing that no psychosis was found. This didn't seem to impress the judge, and so he again committed me to a second 120-day observation. At this point, the psychiatrist or psychologist said that they couldn't cure me, that I was hopelessly insane and could never go to trial. So they were going to take me back to court and dismiss this case due to the fact that I was insane and couldn't assist my attorney. I think they were worried about what I'd say in court and that no one would really believe the government. So they decided instead to keep me in Springfield and just do everything by mail rather than have me go back to court. I was given a dangerousness hearing by a committee of quacks at Springfield to determine if I was a danger to society, if I might injure someone or property or myself if I were released. And the only truth came out that I agree with from this whole thing, that I was no danger. So I passed the dangerousness hearing. Then rather than dismiss it due to incompetency or insanity, Judge Thompson dismissed it in the interest of justice. I believe this is the only escape from a federal prison that has ever resulted in a dismissal in the interest of justice. After just prior to getting out of prison, there was an article on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about a huge cocaine smuggling operation with Rodney Matthews. Apparently these fellows were flying cocaine when the AWACS radar was not up, and it was suspected that they were being tipped off by someone in customs. Then later, it was revealed that Richard Cardwell of U.S. Customs had been arrested for smuggling 25 tons of cocaine along with my old friend Robert Nestorf of the DPS, who wrote the report that stated that I was smuggling cocaine or some... I'm sorry, that I was in this conspiracy to smuggle an unknown drug from an unknown country with unknown co-conspirators. Seems that Nestorov had perjured himself in federal court and also been involved in smuggling 25 tons of cocaine. I brought this to the attention of the U.S. Parole Commission in the form of an appeal, explaining that I thought that I should have a new hearing based on the fact that I had never been arrested and that Nestorov was now being charged with this horrible crime of 25 tons of cocaine, perjury in federal court, and subverting the AWACS radar plane, and that the pilot, Rodney Matthews, was claiming that it was a CIA cocaine smuggling operation. Well, the parole commission, in their infinite wisdom, decided that I deserve no new hearing. Basically, it sounds like to me, Nestorov lies and they swear by it. I don't know what else you can call it. So currently I'm under federal parole. I can't travel out of the Northern District of Texas. I have to submit all of these reports about my purchases of anything over $500, and I have to submit myself to the scrutiny of the parole officer. I believe that this is something like the Communist Party block officer issuing an internal passport for travel in the old Soviet Union. I believe that the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address has evolved into the prison-industrial complex. Let me go back a bit. Ron Gospodarek and Gordon White and my CIA contact in Stockholm, Axel Andersen, George Phillips out of Panama, all concluded that dope is money and that money is power. And they really didn't care if the American public took dope. In fact, they encouraged it for certain people because it kept them pacified and kept them from revolting, especially poor people in ghettos that are disadvantaged. The thing that concerned them was that the wrong people would make money off of it. And if any money was to be made, the U.S. government was going to make the money and control it. I, at one time, believed that the cocaine that I smuggled into the United States would be sold to buy arms. The arms would be used to defeat the Sandinistas. As I stated earlier, I had reported on Cuban and Soviet advisors, as well as Soviet military equipment in Nicaragua. While I was moving around as a drug dealer, I encountered a lot of Soviet arms. This I reported to the CIA. In one instance, a village where I had been buying drugs was literally leveled, and everybody in the village was killed because they had a large supply of Sandinista sympathizers, Cuban advisors, and Soviet military equipment. I felt that I was doing a service for my country. I thought that I was a patriot. I thought I was doing the right thing. Again, after reading the Northern European newspapers, the Latin American newspapers, and talking to my Swedish girlfriend, I realized the U.S. really wasn't very different from the Soviet Union. And there was a lot more than just pretending to smuggle drugs to pay for arms. Incidentally, the Boland Amendment prohibited the arms from being smuggled into Nicaragua to the Contras. But Noriega, North, Casey, Alan Fears, and Clara George decided that they were wiser than Congress and that this could be done anyway, in violation of the Boland Amendment. Some of the tapes that Cesar Rodriguez and I had compiled involved conversations and arms shipments, a lot of information about arms and drugs and money laundering. But none of this has ever been found after my Swedish wife was found on a railroad track and Cesar was found in Colombia with his throat cut and his tongue stuck out. When I did get out of prison in 86, I called my mother-in-law in Sweden and tried to get some information, tried to see my child. She was not very happy with me, and she informed me that I had caused the death of her daughter. And in a roundabout way, she was right. She did explain to me that she had gotten the information out of the safe deposit box in Berlin, was going to give it to the press in East Berlin, and was going to fly back to Stockholm that night on a flight, and she told her mother not to feed the baby because her breast hurt. She wanted the baby hungry when she got home. The next morning, she was informed that her daughter committed suicide on a railroad track. I wasn't there. I don't know what happened. I don't know the whole story, but I think the people can figure it out for themselves. One other thing I'd like to mention is at one point I had gone into Paraguay with a very beautiful Bolivian girl that was Miss Bolivia as my date. This was in August. This is their coolest month in Asunción, and they have a lot of Germans, a lot of people from all over the world that come in there for a festival. And at this festival, the president's son, Alfredo Stroessner's son, wanted to dance with this girl. She explained that it would be rude for her to leave the table by herself because she'd come with an escort, so I was invited to President Stroessner's table so that his son could romance my date. There I met Anastasio Somoza, the deposed dictator of Nicaragua. We exchanged small talk, and then sometime later I realized that the people of Paraguay, at the airport especially, thought that I must be somebody important, and that my gas tank and my airplane was filled free, my airplane was washed, and people sought my opinion on matters of which I knew nothing. In Latin America, if you know someone important, you're a desirable guest, and they would like to make your acquaintance. I reported this back to Cesar Rodriguez in Panama. He then offered me $1 million to take a high-powered rifle and assassinate Anastasio Somoza. I reported this to the CIA. They doubled the guard on Somoza. And I played along with Caesar, telling him that I would try to do it. Eventually, I told him that I just couldn't get close enough, and I just couldn't do it to get somebody else. This was just to buy time. While I was in Panama, I read in the newspaper that some people had taken a bazooka and blown the top off of his Mercedes-Benz in a well-placed shot, and then come in and machine gun the inside of the car. I don't know who did it. I've heard that some people out of Buenos Aires did it. I didn't have anything to do with it, but anyway, the point I try to make is that Cesar Rodriguez was moving in circles where he had information, and if he was involved in something that big and to get that much money, he had pretty good connections. And a lot of this information was what we had compiled and put in the safety deposit box in Berlin. I could tell story after story about arms flights, drug flights, people that I've seen killed. David Smith was a good friend of mine and a pilot. He was from the United States. He flew arms. He flew drugs. I saw him land in Northwest Belize after delivering a load of arms to the Contras in Nicaragua. At about 1,000 feet, I observed a CIA agent pull out a .45 and shoot him and drag his body into the jungle. They told me that he had done something that he shouldn't have done and that I had nothing to worry about as long as I played the game with them. I never knew what David did. I just knew he was never seen or heard from again. And, I mean, something like this was quite common. I think the biggest mistake I ever made was believing in the United States, believing in the integrity of the government, and believing my handlers. I was a naive young man coming out of Richmond, Virginia. I believed in my country. I was against drugs. I've never been a drug user, although I've smoked marijuana, and in several instances I had to use cocaine in order to make myself believable, or I would have been killed. When you're undercover, you do what you can do to survive. But I've never been a drug user. I've never been a person to drink or smoke. I believe in living a clean life. I did believe in the U.S., but I don't believe in it anymore. I think that we've got a government of criminals. I think the courts are corrupt. I think they'll accept perjury. Incidentally,